Session number 22922, Martin Bell, Reel One.
Today is the 22nd of November. We're interviewing Martin Bell at his home. This is for A Century of Killing. Martin Bell, you've been working as, well, had worked as a TV news reporter for 30 years or so, in war zones in many instances. Did you come to any conclusions about human behaviour under those circumstances in war?
I suppose that what struck me is the depth to which mankind can sink, and the against that dark background, the shining heroism that can occur. But I never cease to be amazed at the evil that people could do to each other, and how, in a sense, they could step out of their humanity and become. Oh, it's unkind to animals to say to become animals, because on most species don't kill their own. Ours does.
Would it be true to say that most of the conflicts you witnessed from Northern Ireland via Biafra all the way through to Bosnia, that the main targets of those conflicts seem to be civilian populations?
I think there are two features of modern warfare. One is that we've learned to kill each other on an industrial scale within the last century, on a scale never possible before, which is to say that the technology has advanced, but human nature hasn't. And the other is, yes, civilians are targeted. They're targeted with particular brutality. They're allowed to be targeted, in some cases, by their own political and military leaders, who will use their suffering for leverage in whatever negotiations later occur. But there is absolutely no distinction made between soldiers and civilians, except that by and large soldiers are better able to look after themselves because they're trained to, better equipped, younger. And so it's the civilians who bear the brunt of the suffering and the ordeal, yeah.
You made an interesting remark when we were first here in connection with Bosnia about how communities, societies unravel. Under what circumstances did that take place?
I think that what happened at the end of the Cold War, especially, is that the superpower rivalry changed. There was only one superpower left standing. There were no longer spheres of influence which each would manage. For instance, the Soviet Union had its spheres of influence in Africa, including Angola and Mozambique. Then, with the end of the Cold War, and before that, actually, with the collapse of empire, the Portuguese Empire, what you had then was collapsed societies. Most of the brutal wars of the end of the 20th century, and now the beginning of the 21st, have been about collapsed societies, usually but not always former colonies, societies where the constituent peoples, warlords, tribal chiefs, then fight for supremacy over the dead bodies of their people. And no writ runs, and it has proved extraordinarily hard for the United Nations, if you like, as a neo-colonial power, to restore order in any of these places.
You made an interesting point, whereas we were talking about how propaganda has an impact in mobilizing opinions to sharpen these conflicts. You pointed out that actually the absence of information can be equally deadly. Could you expand on that point?
One of the first things that happens in a collapsed society is that the normal means of news distribution don't apply anymore. There probably won't be newspapers, or if they are, they're just government propaganda sheets. There'll be no electricity, therefore there will be no television, and there will be no radio, because soon enough people's batteries run out. And then they are guided not by information or impartial news or anything like that, but just by the power of rumor. And they will always tend to believe the worst of each other. So I think much more dangerous than the manipulation of news is the news vacuum which occurs, and people believing the worst of each other according to the rumors that are flying around.
Was this particularly true of any particular conflict?
It was certainly true of the Bosnian War. The very first thing the Bosnian Serbs did was to get a hold of their own television service, but that was fairly fragmentary because there wasn't much power, certainly in the conflictive areas. It was something that all signs learned from the old communist regime, that the government ran television, radio, the press. The tradition of the free press, of independent inquiry, was alien to the old Titoist regime, and it was certainly alien to the warlords and political leaders who took over on all sides.
We're making this exhibition in part about genocide, or very largely to do with genocide and mass killings. What do you understand by the term genocide?
I understand deliberate and targeted killing of a group of people because they are that group, usually defined in an ethnic and sometimes a religious context. Their sin or crime or what they're targeted for is their membership of that group. So it doesn't necessarily actually have to be all the members of the group. If you look at the worst war crime since 1945, the massacre of Muslims in genocide, yes, they were taken away and they were cold-bloodedly executed because they were Muslims, but they were also taken away and cold-bloodedly executed because they were Muslim men. They were men of fighting age 16 to 60. So they would be particularly at risk.
You said earlier that you didn't like using the word genocide. Indeed, you never use the word genocide in your reports, although, in fact, looking at your book, it's quite clear that you're not so reluctant to use it there. Why were you generally reluctant to use it?
Genocide implies an organisation, a deliberate, systematic targeting of a particular group. If you look at something like the Ahmici massacre, those people were killed because they were Muslims. They were killed by Croats. But to use the word genocide implies a large-scale operation of that kind. And what we may have been dealing with were isolated cases, dreadful cases. I mean, there were 200 or 300 people there. It didn't seem to me, and this is really an issue for the War Crimes Tribunal to be programmatic, it was just a terrible thing that happened. Whether it was part of the wider picture, I wasn't sure enough at that time. And television can have a terrible effect in making conflict worse. And so I always tried to restrain myself from the use of language which might prove to be both inflammatory and inaccurate.
Yes, could you expand on that point about television reporting making conflict worse? How would it do that?
Television can contribute to the expansion of a conflict or the intensification of a conflict in a number of ways. For instance, reporting rumour as fact. Wherever you are in a war zone, they'll tell you, this terrible atrocity has been committed against our people. Now, you then have an obligation to say, well, where's the evidence? I was once with a bunch of Serbs in Serbian-held territory in Bosnia, and they were talking about the whole Serbian community having been put to the torch and blown up and so on. I said, fine, show me. Oh, it's too dangerous to go up that road. And therefore, you don't mention it at all. You wait for you wait for credible evidence to come in.
The word, or the term, shall I say, ethnic cleansing came into vogue, certainly, at the beginning of the Yugoslav War. What exactly does the term ethnic cleansing mean?
Ethnic cleansing, which I've always never used, I always used reluctantly, and even then in sort of inverted commas, because it's a dreadful euphemism. It means driving people out of a community which they inhabited. Nearly always there will be one route out left. Therefore, the objective is not to kill them, though sometimes mass murder occurs and it's part of it. The objective is to clear them out of that geographical locality, and it was a widespread practice in Bosnia, not by one side only, but at one time or another by all three peoples suffered, and at one time or another all three peoples inflicted it on the other.
Did the term come to be almost another way of saying genocide?
Ethnic cleansing, which is a term I dislike, and genocide, which is a term I rarely use, have certain things in common in that the murder of people because they belong to a particular group can be part of it. But ethnic cleansing is not only about murder, it is about the expulsion of peoples. And genocide is something different. I mean, it's about killing people.
You talk in your book about the corruption of language or the debasement of language in these sort of conflicts. Is that something you could expand on probably?
In terminologically, the Bosnian War was extraordinarily difficult, if only to identify and describe the participating peoples. I mean, how do you describe, for instance, the mainly Muslim government side? Do you have to say they're mainly Muslim all the time any more than you used to say in Northern Ireland, the mainly Roman Catholic SDLP? In fact, the Bosnian government army had as its second in command a Serb. So there were great difficulties of nomenclature. There were difficulties of describing the practice of ethnic cleansing, where it shaded over into genocide, where it didn't. I would always vote on the side of restraint, and partly because in Bosnia the images were so powerful, I thought it was a good place to leave your emotive words in the dictionary and describe things as simply and plainly as you could. But you're always going to be criticised for getting the labelling wrong.
You had lots of contact with the Serbs. In fact, according to your book, you made a point of seeking out and getting their point of view as much as you possibly could, at least to understand it. Among those Serbs who were part of the Bosnian-Serbian political establishment and the army and the Yugoslav Serbian contingent in general, what do you think they thought they were achieving by their policies of driving people out where they came across the population, so to speak?
There's no doubt what the motivation of the Serbs was. The Serbs was the defence of their people and the territory which they felt was historically theirs. And as you know, wherever a Serb lives or lies buried is thought of as Serbian territory. So they struck preemptively in April and May 1992, as they saw it, to defend their people and prevent the genocide of the 1940s coming back, when it was they who suffered mainly at the hands of the Croats. So there was a lot of history there, and I think one of the things you have to understand about the wars of the 20th and 21st century is that the aggression, the killing, is to a large extent initiated and practiced by people who are absolutely convinced of the justice of their cause.
How much were they trapped by their own interpretation of their history?
All the people of the Balkans live their history, I would say, as no other peoples on earth. The Serbs were not exceptional in that. It coloured their view of themselves, and it also affected their view of their chosen enemies, whom they didn't regard as being people in the sense that they were the people, and justice was on their side. But yes, history had a lot to do with it. I think one can point out that General Ratko Mladic, the commander of the Bosnian Serb army, was orphaned at a very early age. He was about 2 when both his parents were killed by the Ustashe. Clearly this would colour his view, and it did colour his view of the Croats. So the dreadful things that happen reach out across the generations. We'll just have to... Is that you, Catherine?
Hello.
Hi. Come on in.
Hi.
I'm just doing an interview. There's a message for you.
No, it's an old message. Don't worry about it. Melissa just told me.
Okay, good. Right. Okay. Okay, that's good. We'll be done in not terribly long.
That's okay, we're leaving again.
You're leaving?
So we're just popping in and out.
Oh, is somebody with you?
Adrian.
Yes.
Okay. But somebody called us, but wasn't it from one of the jobs you went?
No, it was for a sous chef job, which I decided maybe I wouldn't.
Okay.
Really go in
after. Okay. Because I know one of those people was...
Yeah, okay.
You might want to close the door behind you.
Yes.
They can't be guaranteed to maintain absolute silence.
Okay. There's a comment in your book about a conversation you had with a Serb who explained how vicious the conflict had become because of the extraordinary measures they had to take in order to get hold of men to fight, by emptying the prisons and the asylums. How much of...
We've got somebody reversing.
Yeah. I mean, what were the mundane factors do you think that contributed to the
I think it's still,
it's still doing it.
Yes.
So obviously,
is it
the rubbish collection there?
Well, no, it's past. I don't know what it is. We don't get much heavy traffic down here.
It's not big enough, that skip, is it?
I thought it was pretty damn full, actually. Yeah, well, he stopped, isn't he? Who knows, he'll probably start running. He's still running?
Yeah.
Yeah, might as well just, yes. Sorry, I'll put that question again. Were there any particular individual features of the cruelty you witnessed in the Balkans that were absent elsewhere in terms of perhaps the tendency towards cruelty, drink, or the calibre of the people who were the frontline fighters?
The Balkan Wars had a lot of distinguishing characteristics. One was that I have not been in a war zone anywhere else where graveyards became a battlefield. This happened in Vukovar in November 1991, when this town on the Danube, held by the Croats, was overrun by the mainly Serb army, and the tanks were churning up the graveyard, and it prompted the reflection that it wasn't even safe to be dead. Also, in the Bosnian War, the desecration of graves was quite a common characteristic, and I haven't met that elsewhere, not even in Africa. There were some peculiar brutalities, but I think you also have to remember that, in a sense, everybody was imprisoned. Those in enclaves, like the Croats in central Bosnia, couldn't get out. And they were forced into the trenches, into the front line, some quite elderly men you'd find there, because they were obliged to defend their communities. And as the Croats saw it, it was a fight to the death, and they were outnumbered 8 or 9 to 1. On the Bosnian Serb trenches overlooking Sarajevo, you'd find some really old characters, extremely elderly people. I would have thought some of them were even in their late 60s. They also were conscripted. The Serbs were very short of fighting men, in a sense that the Muslims weren't. And so an awful lot of, I mean, obviously they felt they were doing their thing for their people and their nation or their entity, but also because they had to. There was no escape for them either. So they were also living in, I suppose, in the prison of their trenches. Okay, they ran a shift system, but there was no way out. Unless you were young and well-connected, it didn't matter which group you came from, but those who were well-connected sort of managed to spirit themselves away, especially from the centrums from Sarajevo, which was then taken over by refugees from the countryside, by the peasants. And I would say to this day that Bosnia lacks the leadership it should have, because a lot of people went away during the war, and then when the war was over, they had to face the, well, what do you do in the war question? And by that time, they might well feel they'd be much better off to be integrated Europeans, French, British, Germans, especially Germans, rather than try and go back.
You talk about a society where it appears that the majority accepted the legends and myths that were told about themselves. So what made people stand out? Were there people who did sort of sign up to the myth of Serbian greatness if they were Serbs, or seen themselves as Muslims if they happened to be born Muslim?
One effect of this civil war, which was also a war of external aggression, was it intensified and I think also distorted people's view of their tribal identity, if I can so put it. In this way, the Orthodox Church assumed some importance because it was a symbol of Serbian nationhood, if you like. The Church had a very strong influence on the Croats. They harked back, the Croats did, to the Ustaše puppet state. And you suddenly find pictures of Ante Pavelić, its leader, on the back of cars, especially in Herzegovina. They all had heroic notions of themselves. And on the Muslim side, I think the effect was to intensify their sense of being Muslim. They're very European Muslims before the war. They drank, they played music. They didn't wear much in the way of distinctive coverings. But as the war went on, especially in a town like Zenica, you would find them it became almost increasingly Middle Eastern to look at. And Mehmet Alagic, who won the great battle for Mount Vlasic, was much reproached afterwards within the Muslim community for having celebrated his victory with alcohol.
In your book, you describe war as a bad taste business. What kind of problems did you have in reporting the war to Yugoslavia, wars in general?
The problems that I had, well, there are two sorts of problems. There are problems of access and getting past those damned roadblocks. And then there are problems when you've got past the damned roadblocks and you've done the business of being allowed to use the footage you shot without being being censored by the good taste censors in London. I think the BBC went to extreme lengths. It was extremely worried because it had seen what its audience research said. And the audience research said that people, didn't matter how much bloodshed was shown on fictional television, but factual television was different, and people didn't want to be upset by it. Well, guess what? War is a deeply upsetting business, and I think we were obliged, we should have shown much more than we did. But this was a battle which I waged with my own editorial masters for 3.5 years, and on the whole I lost it, though. I think the debate, we managed to move the debate a bit, at least in the famous watershed, then after 9 o'clock, we were allowed to be more specific than we were before. What I felt about it was that if you cut out all the violence, all the bloodshed, then you showed war as an acceptable way of settling differences, and that was immoral. And I think today, there's always a tendency to glorify war. Well, if you don't, if you see these people blazing away with their Kalashnikovs in the ruins, that can almost look romantic. Certainly if you're not allowed to see what happens at the other end. I once included in a report a man on patrol, a Croat, actually being shot and dying on camera. He just fell out of the frame. I got in a lot of trouble with that afterwards because I managed to sneak it in, and it was only when it was actually transmitted that they realized what I'd done. But I thought it was necessary because in war people do actually get killed.
What were you hoping would emerge from your coverage of this particular conflict?
I would distinguish between effect and intention. The intention was to show the thing, and it's always going to be fragmentary, as nearly as accurately as I could. The effect might well be to interest the world community, that especially the European powers, that we had a responsibility for war in our backyard, and that was the effect. It made the diplomats uncomfortable. But did I go about saying, let's stir up trouble for the Foreign Office? No, I didn't. Not at all. I was much too close to the ground, but I never had any... I never knew what the effect was. But I think that in the end, if lives were saved, which otherwise would have been lost, we have nothing for which to apologise.
You comment very caustically in the section in your book about the reaction of diplomats, ministers, particularly Douglas Hurd, who seem to be implying actually that you were trying to make a case for intervention, the Do Something School. Could you comment on that?
Something must be done. School of journalism, I think, is an invention of Douglas Hurd. You can look at my scripts for all those 3.5 years. I don't think I ever sent something must be done. I did do a slightly polemical panorama in February '93, in which I concluded that our reaction to that, this was the worst of the war. Our reaction was really a test of who we are, and did we care? But I think. Frankly, the British government had very little idea what to do. Douglas Hurd had the chairmanship of the Council of Ministers in the critical first summer, and he came out and he looked absolutely, completely baffled. I think looking back on it now, he may wish he'd taken certain actions, which were taken in the end, but could have been taken much earlier. But it wasn't British diplomacy's finest hour. But I've never singled him out for attack. I reported his visit to Sarajevo. Also, the effect that in the end he seemed almost to run away. The Bosnian government thought that they'd agreed he should go and visit the city's hospital, this famous doomed hospital, and they were all ready to sort of turn right and the main street, but he just went barreling straight on down to the UN headquarters and then home. But I haven't heard his side of that story.
Why, for you, in the end, was Bosnia the important story?
I suppose it was the last war I covered. Everything else had been, in a sense, leading up to it. We were closer to the We were closer to the suffering and the ordeals of ordinary people. We didn't share their dangers because we could get out and they didn't. But we lived in a hotel which was on the front line. We raced up and down Sniper's Alley. We saw what was going on every day. We were witnesses of the relative impotence of the United Nations. Did it matter that it was in Europe? I suppose it was easier to sell as a story that it was only two hours and a bit flying time from London. Shouldn't have been so, but it was. It was easier to get it on the air because we had a substantial number of British troops involved. It was just so dreadful, and in my view it didn't have to happen the way it happened, that it was, to me, the most touching, moving, important story I ever covered. You know, and I started in Vietnam.
I get the sense from your book that you saw it as perhaps the conflict that might lead to a severe unravelling.
I saw it as a very consequential war. I think I described it as the most consequential war of our times because one of these wars led to another. If it had not been for the Croatian war and the early and premature piecemeal recognition of Croatia, the Bosnian war certainly wouldn't have happened when it did happen. It might have been prevented by diplomacy and by the Hague Conference, which was chaired by Lord Carrington. And this in its turn would lead on to other conflicts, as indeed happened in, you know, Kosovo was always a powder keg waiting to be ignited, and Macedonia to this day. And I think that the objective of Western diplomacy was what I could call it fire blanket diplomacy, or at least to ring fence the whole thing so it didn't spread. It could easily have spread into Bulgaria, into Greece, and so on. So I suppose that limited objective was achieved, but at what a cost, what a terrible cost.
We were talking about Rwanda earlier. I don't know whether you were there, but why was perhaps so much attention paid to Bosnia, and why did so little seem to come out of Rwanda?
As I remember the Rwandan conflict as a viewer, and I wasn't there on the ground because it more or less coincided with the Bosnian War, it received a tremendous amount of attention over a short period, and the news media then got tired of it. I think there was a degree of racism in this. It was easier to get a European war on the screens than it was an African war. But I also think that there were technical factors as well. It is difficult to get all your techno junk and gear, and the satellite dishes were bigger then than they are now, into a country like Rwanda. There's all kinds of obstacles in the way. The costs are greater. Remember, foreign news is an expensive operation. Even the BBC counts its costs. And they would pull out as soon as they could. And I think what you had for a while was and this is a characteristic of modern journalism. There'll be intense scrutiny of one story at one time. We've only got appetite for one war, and everything else is going to be ignored. Well, Rwanda had a very short period in the journalistic sun, so to speak, and Bosnia a very long one. Though by the time March 95 came around, I was meeting a lot of resistance on the Bosnian War. Oh, not another 100 people killed. You know, they said that they weren't interested. They'd seen it before. Editors have a very short attention span. And this was the beginning of the dumbing down of news. I would say the news began to be dumbed down in the early 90s, and by the end of the decade, the process was far advanced. And let's name names. ITN led the way. ITN decided that foreign news didn't draw in viewers, and it pushed back its foreign news to one package on Tuesdays and one on Thursdays, generally. And it got more interested in royalty and lifestyle items and medical research. And the BBC followed a bit down the same path on the pretext, calling it news you can use. So these two events, the Rwandan war and the Bosnian war, both happened as the television news companies were adjusting their notion of what news was.
Is the idea of showing black men cutting each other up with machetes more acceptable than the idea of white men doing the same thing, do you think?
I have to believe that there is a measure of racism in the extent to which atrocities can be described and shown when they're practiced in Africa and not when they're practiced in Europe. This is an objective fact. I think it's disgraceful, but clearly it has happened.
You talk about in your book, you describe Operation Irma and that, the incident of a little girl. Is there any harm, do you think, that kind of journalism where perhaps through a human interest story, an audience actually gets to know about the wider picture?
There's something that journalists always do when they come to a country they don't know, television journalists especially. They'll seek out, A, the expatriates, and B, the orphanage. The story of Irma, I suppose, was a very touching story of this very badly wounded child. And at the moment, I thought, well, okay, that's television news. But I think it was cynical and exploitative. One of the generals at the time, one of the UN generals, and gave his view that Irma was an acronym of the Instant Response to Media Attention. I don't think it showed the television companies really in a very good light. Because actually what actually happened was that as a result of this story, which was on the BBC, the British government, Downing Street, reacted and sent a plane to fetch out Irma and a number of others. And some of the others turned out to be men of military age. Well, actually, you can justify that, because as soon as a soldier is wounded, he ceases to be a soldier. What struck me at the time, not long before that, a battle had taken place on a Muslim-Croat front line, which went right across an institution, a psychiatric institution. I called it a madhouse. I wasn't allowed to use the word madhouse because it was politically incorrect. But a battle over a madhouse would seem to me the absolute absurdity to which the war had descended. But there was no international clamour to get these poor, mentally retarded people out of the war zone. A little blonde girl is different. And that's what's wrong with television news. It's exploitative and blind.
You talk about CNN, Zach.
Oh, Newsack. Newsack is what looks like news and sounds like news but isn't news. Newsack is rolling news. Newsack is filling the unforgiving 24 hours. And you don't actually have that many original pictures. What you have, and it's happened to an extreme degree in the Afghan war, what you have are people standing on hotel rooftops, the hotels, and we never had one in the Holiday Inn, it was too dangerous, the hotels being in safe and comfortable places. The correspondents stand on these rooftops and they will exchange guesswork with other correspondents standing on other hotel rooftops. All this done at enormous cost. There was a famous CNN correspondent at the time, Peter Arnett, who, like me, began in Vietnam, where he made his name. And he still on this rooftop. I saw him. He turned up there one morning, got out his bag with his makeup, dabbed his face, and he put his powder on. And then he did 14 live shots, one after the other. And at one point, since he really was a journalist, he appealed to head office in Atlanta. Well, can I go out and find out what's actually going on? Oh, sure, they said, that's fine, just be back in 40 minutes. I mean, it is a complete waste of time, and I think a lot of serious journalists have come to see that. It's what I call rooftop television.
If we have difficulty resolving the information that comes through in that kind of third-hand way, how do agencies like the United Nations cope with trying to make a decision as to which way to go? I mean, what did you think of the United Nations where you've seen it at work?
The United Nations has some wonderful people in it. Its soldiers, I thought, were extremely brave. Its present Secretary General, I believe, I've got a high regard for. The United Nations is no stronger than its the constituent governments, who will all have their own political agendas. And a UN force, like all multinational forces, has inherent weakness, because the various contingents will have two chains of command. One goes up to the UN commander in New York, and the other goes back to the capital city. And the chain of command of the capital city is always the stronger, because the UN officers are temporarily wearing a blue helmet, but they're going back to regular soldiering in their armies. There was a time in 1994 in Bosnia when General Rose, the British general, British UN commander, wanted to deploy some British troops to one of the enclaves surrounded by the Serbs. His hand was stayed by Whitehall, by his own Ministry of Defence, who refused to allow him to do it because they didn't want those British troops to go there. That's the weakness of multinational soldiering, and it's hard to see how the UN is ever going to solve this problem unless it has its own standing army, which I think is unrealistic.
Any other ways that the UN might be able to, let's say, get its act together?
There are ways in which the UN can and is getting its act together. It establishes, it has got a kind of permanent headquarters which can now move in at fairly short notice. It's been doing a lot of training of troops, especially done by the Scandinavians in multinational soldiering. It's learning from its past mistakes. There actually is a lessons learned department, I think on the 17th or 18th floor of the UN building in New York. But whatever it does, it's dependent on the contributing nations and on the members of the Security Council, above all.